Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan on News Talk.
Photojournalism might seem to be a glamorous profession. You're travelling to the world's troubled spots and disseminating images all around the globe, but it can come with a cost too, both physical and emotional. Cathal McNaughton is the only photojournalist on this island to win a Pulitzer Prize. Cathal, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
You started your career, if you like, the old-fashioned way as an apprentice.
I did indeed. I started as a 16-year-old in the dark room of the Irish News in Belfast.
And how did you get to that? Had you a grow to be a photojournalist at that point?
No, the one driving thing that brought me to the dark room was my dislike of education and school. So it was an option that was available to me, and I took it with both hands at the time.
Yeah. So was it the darkroom skills you learned first before they kind of sent you out onto the street?
Well, it was traditional, where I was, you know, cleaning up the darkroom, devving films, and watching how the printed pictures and stuff. And because the streets of Belfast were quite a dangerous place at the time, so you wouldn't want to be thrown straight out onto the streets without some sort of a build up to it, especially coming from a rural community like myself.
Yeah, so you would have then spent, I suppose, some time shadowing other photographers.
Yeah. In the early days, I spent my time following Brendan Murphy, the late picture editor and my kind of mentor. And then eventually, when I broke out on my own, I would watch the other international photojournalists when they would come over to cover the assignments in the north of Ireland.
Yeah. And so, and as I understand it, your first assignment, your first solo assignment was OMA.
It was one of the first sort of major assignments I was given, and it was only because it was all hands on deck, so they needed all the help they could get. So I was sent to OMA just whenever the OMA bomb happened. So it was a real baptism of fire, so to speak, at the time.
Yeah, but you were only 21.
Yeah. 21, even that seems like a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I had been rocking about the streets of Belfast and covering different things on up until that. But this was the first major news event where I was let off the leash, and I was given an opportunity to prove what I could do.
Mm. And you did. I think you took some photographs that day that did make the front page.
I did. I took some pictures that were well received, and it's a very, very unfortunate event. So it's bittersweet, really. I don't like saying too much about that. But yeah, I didn't do too bad. But it also taught me how little I knew at the same time, you know, because it was quite fortunate, let's say, to do as well as I did.
Yeah. And so when did the international career start?
Well, from watching all the other photojournalists coming flying in and flying out from Bosnia and different places like that, I realized that's what I wanted to do. So I took quite a traditional path. I then moved on to working for bigger agencies. I was based in Dublin for a while, then moved to London to work there. And that's when things really took off, and I started traveling more globally.
Yeah, have you counted up how many countries you've been to?
No, you're trying to depress me now. No, I've been to quite a few countries over the years. Actually, I can't remember some of the countries I've been to.
Yeah.
But sometimes for very good reasons. Unfortunately, a lot of the times for bad reasons as well.
Yeah, yeah. And when you would be, and I suppose this would be kind of when you're, when you're a little more experienced in working as an international photojournalist, when you arrive someplace and you don't know the language, and maybe you don't know your way around, would you have done a lot of research in advance, or you know, how would you navigate, because there may be local difficulties or not that you're not aware of?
Yeah, so preparation is the key, and the more preparation you can do, the better. and also when you're going away to foreign assignments where maybe you don't speak the language or the situation on the ground is quite fluid, you would try and hook up with a fixer or maybe another photojournalist or journalist that you knew or know on the ground. And because you don't want to be going into these places cold, really, because it's your work will suffer and your own personal safety could suffer as well. So you have to be very mindful of that.
Mm. And presumably the fixer would have enough local knowledge to say, just don't take your camera out at all here. And, you know, maybe in half an hour when we move to a different area.
Well, yeah, this is a tricky thing as well, because you're trusting an awful lot in somebody that you maybe don't know.
Mm.
So that the idea is that you try and get somebody that has been used by maybe a colleague or that beforehand, and they'll know how a photographer works, because sometimes you have to, there is no safe way of doing something. You just have to do it. And so you have to strike that balance where you haven't got somebody that's hindering you or in your goals.
Mm.
So yeah, it can be a very difficult relationship to have.
Yeah. And I would imagine you, if that kind of itinerant lifestyle where you're in lots of different countries and moving around a bit, did you, to an extent, kind of sacrifice a lot of your personal life to just concentrate on work?
Yeah, well, that's it. That's the price I paid for what I was doing. I couldn't, it had to be all or nothing, really. You know, I either give everything to what I was doing, or it would be nothing. And so, yeah, it cost me a lot personally and with relationships and, yeah, my personal life, family and friends. And so that is something I've had to come to terms with, but I found a more even balance now. But yes, it may sound glamorous, but, you know, being in the Himalayas is beautiful, but when you're on your own, you know, who do you share these things with? So after a while, it you know, one hotel room looks the same as the next.
Yeah. Now, and also there must be kind of an ongoing, I don't know if struggle is the right word, but, you know, you have to get an image. You have to get an image that tells a story. And sometimes that's in the midst of a situation where horrific things are happening around you. Is it possible to keep a distance?
Well, you have to. Not everybody's cut out for this job. And so you have to be able to compartmentalize things and slow down. So whenever things are happening around you at a pace, that is when I try and slow down and become very selective about what I'm shooting, rather than getting caught up in all the adrenaline and the excitement of cracks and whistles going on around you. So yeah, that's one of the main things, is to be able to slow down when everything else around you is chaotic.
Mm. Also, as well, you know, I assume if one is a photographer, especially if there's some sort of violence going on, that the temptation is always to go for that dramatic, violent image. But is there, you know, we see so much of that stuff nowadays that there's a danger of people are desensitized to it. And so is there a kind of a struggle in trying to find something that tells that story, but not in that, you know, kind of attention grabbing way, which doesn't grab attention anymore?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is to try and get people to because we suffer from compassion fatigue, most of us, you know, because we're confronted with dreadful scenes every day, more so now than ever. So you're always looking for a different way to tell a story. And sometimes it's not the most obvious thing that can be the most poignant. For example, I was in Ukraine a couple of years back, and there are some horrific images coming from Ukraine, and the photographers out there are doing an amazing job. But I was there for a short period of time, so I decided, how could I make my images maybe stand out from some of the rest of the stuff coming from the front line? So I focused on capturing the ordinary in the war zone. So it was people going about their everyday lives, but within a conflict situation. So people eating at restaurants, but maybe a row of tanks in the background, or children playing again in front of bombed out tanks. So it's just always looking for a different way to capture people's imagination and to make these images and the story stick as well.
Are you and when you're choosing those images to send them back to base, are you thinking the image has to be self-contained in that sense, or are you kind of relying on there being some text to go along with it to explain the context of the picture?
Well, ideally, if you can tell the story without there being any text, then you've done something, you know, pretty special. But a lot of pictures can be taken out of context, so it's very, very important to have the correct information to go along with it. And then when you send it out into the world, you just cross your fingers and hope that it's used in the correct manner and not used for different reasons or slanted in a particular way.
Yeah. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, you, as part of a team, it should be said, did win a Pulitzer. And this is for the work that you did in Kashmir.
No, it was actually the work that we did in Bangladesh, of the Rohingya genocide, the Rohingya refugees fleeing Myanmar.
And how long were you there for?
Personally, I was only there for, I was there for 2 or 3 weeks, something like that. We were working on a rotational basis, because after about 3 weeks, you get used to seeing the same thing over and over again, and that's never a good thing. So you need fresh eyes to come in, and also you need people to come in fresh, because it was quite an exhausting environment to be working in. But that was a very, very interesting period of my life. And you rightly say, yes, I was part of a team of a few other Reuters photographers that were awarded the Pulitzer.
Yeah. Now, but it was a genocide you were reporting on. So it was a bit more than interesting, I imagine. Probably when you left the situation and the adrenaline stops coursing.
Yeah, well, again, this is the thing. It's not the big blockbuster moments that always are the things that stick in your head. Like, the one thing that sticks in my head from the Rohingya genocide wasn't the, you know... It's just probably one moment where during the monsoon, because it was the monsoon season, that a family insisted that I come inside their tarpaulin tent. You wouldn't even call it a tent. And there was nothing in it, and the water was just running underneath it. There was literally nothing in this apart from one log. And this log was the only place you could sit that you would be dry in the entire place. And they insisted that I sat on this log for the length of the range. Now, it was very uncomfortable, because they were just staring at me the whole time. But the humanity of these people to give me the only thing that they had where I could sit and be dry, as they sat on the muck, basically, as the water washed under their tent. They didn't even have pots and pans. They had one log. And it's things like that stick with you more than a lot of the other things.
Yeah, because because it was a humanitarian crisis going on there as well, apart from the genocidal aspect to it. People were starving.
Yeah, that's it. You were seeing people, and they were arriving on boats and through the jungle, and they were making their way to these camps, and they had some sort of hope, but what you realized, or I knew, that what they were arriving to wasn't much better than what they had left. Yes, of course, they weren't going to be shot or killed or anything, but there was no food, there was no infrastructure, there was no nothing. And it wasn't going to change for a very long time. So their journey had only just begun. It hadn't ended. And it's having that knowledge is quite difficult.
Yeah. Now, I got mixed up with between the two horrific scenarios. But then you were in, then later on, you were doing work in Kashmir. Is it fair to say Kashmir, then, you might see a parallel between Kashmir and Northern Ireland in terms of the political dynamic of it?
100%. And that's one of the reasons why I kept going back. whenever I was based in Delhi, is because of the parallels. So yeah, Kashmir actually, it was Kashmir is the reason I'm back in Ireland, funnily enough, because it was my work in Kashmir that got me kicked out of the country. But yeah, Kashmir holds a special place in my heart. It's a very, very, the situation there is pretty intense, and there's certain forces don't want anybody really to know about it.
Mm. As in, a portion of the population see the regard themselves as occupied, and another portion of the population think they're at home, which is probably oversimplifying it, but that's kind of largely seems to be what's going on there. When you were there, did the Indian authorities want you to be there, or did they tolerate you being there?
Well, they tolerate you being there. Now, the thing is that they tried to say that I had breached the terms of my visa, but that's almost impossible to do, because the whole time I was there, I was being followed by the police, and they weren't very discreet about it, and they were ringing the play at the houseboat and stuff that I was staying in multiple times a day. They were following me in the streets, and you have to sign into the region, and then you have to apply for a curfew pass to allow you to operate outside the hours of the or within the hours of the curfew. So, you know, they do everything they can to make life difficult for you, let's just say, but that only makes you more determined as a journalist too, and it only makes you more aware that what you're doing is correct. If a government has got so much issue with you being there reporting in a story, well, alarm bells should be ringing immediately, you know.
Yeah. So so was it? Is this correct? You were actually on your way back from New York, having received the Pulitzer. You arrive back in Delhi, and they just turn you on your heel and stick you back on the plane again.
Yeah, it, looking back on it now, it's quite funny. But at the time, it was far from funny. So, yeah, I arrived back from the Pulitzer thinking everything was great. I was going to maybe relax and share this moment with my friends and my partner at the time. And I didn't even get through customs, and they wouldn't tell me the reason why. They basically took me away into a side room, didn't ask me any questions, and eventually one man just says, you'll not be entering India today. And I was escorted back onto the very same plane I arrived on, like some sort of criminal, and unaware of what was happening. And that was the last contact I ever had with the Indian authorities.
But you had a home there and possessions there and all that kind of stuff.
The whole works, yes. My whole life, apart from my son, of course, but my whole life at the time was in India. My job, everything.
Yeah. And
my beloved motorbike was even there, but I've rescued it. So,
well, at least you got some of that valuable stuff out. Now, your parents were poorly at the time, so you made the decision to return home and help look after them. Given though that you'd been living this kind of life and doing this kind of job, to suddenly kind of come to a halt, or to have to, was it difficult to readjust to a much slower pace of life and one that didn't involve having cameras around your neck?
Yeah, to be honest, I would say it's like going cold turkey, because I was addicted and obsessed with what I did and have been for many, many years. And then to have to stop it, like with no tapering or anything like that, it was very, very tough mentally for me, and it took a long, long time to try and come to terms with that. And but like all good addicts, I'm now back taking photographs again. So
but the gap was how many years?
Yeah, it was 4 to 5 years. There was a lot of stuff happening with my parents, and I had to Sean, I had no choice, really. I didn't want to leave my job at the time, but your parents are your parents, and I had to make a decision, and I made the decision. It was the right one, but it was a very, very tough one, and I'll never regret that decision, but it doesn't make it any easier to live with.
Yeah.
So, because that's 4 years of my life that's you know, my career. But, you know, what's a career at the end of your life? It's not really anything, is it? Yeah. So I just have to brush myself off and get back at it again.
And now that you're back at it again, do you find you're working differently? Is the experience of it slightly different?
Yeah, I'm a totally different person now, to be honest. There was a lot of self-reflection over the past few years. And even the way I take photographs has changed slightly. But one of the features, I believe, of my photography anyway has always been the empathy in it. And I don't think that has changed at all. If anything, it's increased. But now I'm working on my own project at the minute. And so that's what my focus is on now.
Yeah. And what is that project?
Well, the project, it's called the Island Project. And what it is I'm going to spend at least the next couple of years traveling the island of Ireland and documenting contemporary Ireland as it is now. Everything from, you know, direct provision to immigrants to race riots to the old lady working in the corner shop to the shamrocks and the shillelaghs, all of it. And then, so in 15, 20, 50, 100 years, people can look back and see the pictures and they're able to say that was Ireland then. That is what Ireland looked like then. So, and I think Ireland, or the island of Ireland, is going through so many changes at the minute, and there could be one giant change in the next few years. Who knows?
Mm.
North and south. So I think now's the time to do it, and I think I'm in the right place mentally to undertake this task at the minute.
Yeah, that'll be a hell of a story to tell. I assume you still use proper cameras rather than you haven't kind of gone, well, you know, phones are fine now, or are they?
No, I still use cameras. Now, phones can do a good job, yes, no doubt. But no, I'm a photographer, a photojournalist, and I'll be using my cameras until the point where there is no difference in them. You know, I'm not a Luddite or anything. You know, I'll move with the times as much as anybody has to. You know, I embrace digital photography wholeheartedly. So yeah, I'll continue on just with whatever technical advances there are.
Carl, we look forward to seeing the results from your Ireland project, and thanks a million for talking with us today. That was the photojournalist Carl McNaughton there.
Lunchtime Live with Andrea Gilligan. Weekdays at midday on News Talk. Conversation that counts.